Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Sun Sounds of Arizona. The program is Business World. We're going to change our format just a bit this week. I'm going to read you several short articles, one of which definitely applies to all of you. This is from Fortune magazine, dated March 17th. Here's the article, and it is not titled. It's not just your average drivers feeling the pain at the pump in recent weeks. With the price of diesel spiking more than 36% in the past month, farmers, shipping companies, and the retail industry are all seeing an impact, and that could soon mean higher prices for just about everything. The cost of all products will rise, energy economist Philip Vergler told Reuters. A spike in global crude oil prices resumed in early trading on Tuesday, as Iran continues to strike oil infrastructure and shipping in the Gulf region. The global benchmark Brent crude index rose to $104 per barrel, up more than 3.7% compared to Monday's close, an increase that comes after Iran's foreign minister said that the strait would be closed only for tankers and shipping belonging to our enemies. So, what are the results with regard to gas prices? Here are some current gas price averages for Maricopa County. As of March 17th, the price of regular ranged from $4.13 to $4.64. The overall average was $4.35. The average price of premium, $5.04 a gallon. 1 month ago, regular's average price was $3.14 and premium's average price was $3.85. So the Iranian conflict has definitely made a difference in prices. Once again, please remember, these prices will change rapidly. You will be hearing this on Monday, the 23rd of March. I am recording it on the 17th of March. So do expect all levels of gas prices to be different by that time, and the price of Brent crude will probably have changed as well. Now, with regard to jet fuel, again from Fortune magazine, dated March 16th, the price of jet fuel is up 57% since the U.S. began airstrikes on Iran, presenting what Deutsche Bank analyst Michael Lindbergh called an existential threat for U.S. airlines. In response, carriers have said they will raise fares to pass on the cost, and experts say travelers should book summer trips now, though they recommend avoiding restrictive basic economic fares, so travelers can still cancel and rebook if prices drop. And now here's a quick one on the state of the U.S. economy. Again, Fortune magazine, again, March 16th. A spate of data released Friday painted an increasingly negative picture of the U.S. economy, most of it from before the Iran war began. The economy grew less than previously recorded in the fourth quarter of 2025, with the Department of Commerce revising GDP growth from 1.4% to just 0.7%. That's a major shift from 4.4% in the previous quarter and reflects downward revisions to exports, consumer spending, government spending, and investment, according to the report. Adding concerns about rising prices, the Federal Reserve's preferred inflation metric ticked up in January. The core PCE price index, which excludes the volatile food and energy prices, was 3.1% in the first month of 2026, coming in above consensus analyst estimates and well above the central bank's 2% target. The Federal Reserve is now almost certain to hold interest rates steady at its meeting this week, according to CME's FedWatch tool. And the University of Michigan's latest survey provided a window into how the Middle East conflict is weighing on consumer sentiment. Interviews conducted before the U.S. attacked Iran showed improving views on the economy, but lower readings after the attack completely erased those initial gains, said Joanne Hugh, the survey's director. Here's our final article on the state of the U.S. economy, again from Fortune magazine, dated the 16th of March, written by Eleanor Pringle. Recession and stagflation risks are rising due to Iran conflict, as economist warns it's getting harder to argue disruption will be temporary. as oil prices once again topped $100 a barrel, the damn the torpedoes confidence Wall Street analysts have had since the U.S. and Israel undertook strikes and Iran took another knock. Economists have lived in hope that President Trump is unlikely to pursue the campaign beyond the end of the month, arguing the White House won't want to see energy prices inflate in a midterm year. However, volatility across the tickers is making it hard for analysts to maintain a sense of calm. The unease relates to the worsening geopolitical situation. A string of attacks was launched this week on oil ships in the Persian Gulf, and assurances of military escorts from the U.S. Navy are yet to emerge. Likewise, attacks on the country's neighboring Iran are continuing. Dubai has reported a number of drone attacks, while Kuwait's airport has also been targeted. Investors are increasingly pricing in a more protracted conflict that causes extensive economic damage, noted Deutsche Bank's Jim Reed to clients this morning. The outlook of investors hasn't been helped by the latest monthly report from the International Energy Agency, which wrote today that the war in the Middle East is creating the largest supply disruption in history of the global oil market. Iran has reportedly dismissed the notion of a ceasefire, while President Trump has maintained there is practically nothing left to target in Iran. No concrete evidence of de-escalation in the region has been confirmed, Reed notes as a result. That's keeping oil prices elevated and raising the risk of a broader stagflationary shock. With each passing day, it gets harder to argue that the disruption to shipping and energy infrastructure will only prove temporary. Stagflation is the combination of high inflation stemming from energy prices, higher unemployment, while the U-rate is 4.4% according to the latest report from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, job reports have continued to be weak, and stagnating economic growth quarter two and quarter three GDP figures were relatively strong. But the estimations for quarter four have fallen to 1.4%. The latest tip over $100 barrel oil means we're also getting closer to the territory that's historically led to bigger risk-off moves, noted Reed. Economists don't have to look far back for evidence of what that might look like. Russia's invasion of Ukraine in 2022 pushed energy prices sky high. We're not there yet, and the global economy isn't battling inflation in the wake of a pandemic. However, Reed adds, clearly, the longer that oil remains at these levels, expectations of a sustained shock will only grow. Analysts have also been drawing up projections for how deep the chaos would need to be to push the U.S. economy into a recession. There's some way to go, according to Oxford Economics chief global economist Ryan Sweet and director of global macro research Ben May, though not impossible. In the duo's modeling, global oil prices would need to average $140 per barrel for 2 months to pose a recessionary risk. The U.S. would also have to face significant tightening in financial market conditions, heightened supply chain disruptions, and a continuing deterioration in the collective psyche. Potentially easy to imagine if the Middle East conflict dragged on longer than expected and disruption in the Strait of Hormuz continued. Sweet and May ran a simulation that assumes Brent crude oil hits $140 per barrel for 8 weeks, meaning natural gas prices rise in turn and negative spillover effects on global real GDP sit around 0.7% by the end of 2026. The results were mild contractions in the Eurozone, the UK, and Japan, while the U.S. edged toward a temporary standstill with layoffs pushing up the unemployment rate. We're also considered a less severe alternative, where oil prices average around $100 per barrel for 2 months, which would shave a few tenths of a percentage point off global GDP growth via higher inflation. But recession would be avoided, the pair continued. Indeed, Bank of America economist Aditya Bhave argued this week that Wall Street may have already been misreading signals when it comes to the Middle East. Many investors have expected the Fed to freeze any base rate action until the inflationary impact of energy becomes clear in the data. Though Bhave argued, policy risks play out when demand is strong, enough for activity to withstand a supply shock, such as in 2022. He added, by contrast, we now have a soft labor market, moderately elevated inflation, and more modest fiscal support. This sets us up for a more dovish Fed response if the oil shock is persistent. Now we've covered the negative repercussions of the Straits of Hormuz blockage. However, who wins? Who actually makes money because of this blockage? There is an answer to that question, actually more than one. We're going to go into two of them today. This article is from Forbes magazine by Giacomo Tognini, and it is titled, "The World's Richest Shipper is an Unlikely Winner from the Iran War." In December, South Korean shipping firm Sinokor Merchant Marine quietly started buying up supertankers. It marked a major shift for the 36-year-old company that had largely been focused on container shipping. Then, in January, news broke that Sinokor was buying as many of the largest oil tankers, known as Very Large Crude Carriers, or VLCCs, that it could get its hands on. There's now a Korean company that has gone out berserkly, and they're buying every single ship, Nicholas Sakos, founder of tanker firm Sakos Energy Navigation, told Forbes in January. The last month has been crazy. By the end of January, maritime freight management firm Vesson Nautical estimated that Sinokor had bought more than $2.5 billion worth of VLCCs. By March, that was up to $3.3 billion for at least 60 ships. But Sinokor may not have been acting alone. At the same time that Sinokor was making headlines with its buying spree, other reports started to emerge that suggested the world's largest shipping tycoon, Gianluigi Appati, net worth $43.8 billion, was actually behind Sinokor's spending spree. At the end of January, industry publication Lloyd's List wrote that Sinokor's purchases were being funded by Appati, but noted that the relationship remained shrouded in secrecy, while two ship owners who sold ships to Sinokor told Bloomberg in early February that the final buyer of their tankers was an entity linked to Appati. Altogether, Sinokor and or MSC now command a fleet of 76 supertankers worth an estimated $6.7 billion per Vesson Nautical. That makes up 8% of the total supertanker fleet, making the pair the largest owner of ships in the world. Some put that figure even higher. Publicly traded competitor Okeanis Eco Tankers estimates that Sinokor controls at least 17% of the total fleet and 39% of the spot fleet, meaning ships available for immediate short-term voyages. It's still a bit unclear what the plan is, but there's been some speculation that they're trying to corner the markets, says Fredrik Dybwad, an analyst at Oslo-based maritime and energy investment firm Fearnley Securities. They're trying to get as big a market share as they can so they can basically have pricing power on the rates. It's never been done before in shipping. What's clear is that Appati has made a smart bet on supertankers at just the right time, as the Iran war and the closure of the Strait of Hormuz push rates to record highs. Spot rates for voyages from still accessible ports in the Middle East to China shot up to a record $485,959 per ship per day on Friday, according to Vesson Nautical, while one-year charters, longer-term contracts with a fixed rate, hit $111,000 per ship per day, beating their pandemic high. On Wednesday, Sinokor's Gabon Prosperity tanker booked a contract for transporting oil from the Red Sea to India at $356,938 per day, per Lloyd's List. The firm is also reportedly earning up to $500,000 per ship per day on several tankers it has sitting in the Persian Gulf for simply storing oil, waiting until the Strait of Hormuz reopens. At least while the war in Iran persists, money will keep flowing. We don't know how long these rates stay at these levels. We know it's temporary, but the cash flow is permanent, said Liam Burke, an analyst at B. Riley Securities at the Capital Link International Shipping Forum in New York on March 9th. Still, this is a longer-term strategy with more deals in the works. Tsakos told Forbes his firm is in talks to sell two of their tankers to Sinokor for about $110 million apiece. Other competitors expect Sinokor and MSC's buying to continue, seeking to further push up rates as they expand their control over the market. Everyone would benefit from that if they're able to do it, says Dybwad. I'm skeptical, because shipping is such a fragmented industry, with a lot of small owners who can come in and disrupt their strategy of trying to control the price in the market. But if they're able to do it, it would be hugely positive. The tanker splurge is just the latest in a multi-year spending binge for Aponte, the 85-year-old Swiss-Italian billionaire who was the co-founder and co-owner, alongside his wife, Raffaella, of container shipping giant MSC. The COVID-19 pandemic sent freight rates skyrocketing, giving MSC tens of billions of dollars in cash, some of which it spent to amass the world's largest container fleet by early 2022. Between January 2022 and March 2025, Forbes estimates that MSC spent more than $40 billion buying up more container ships, ports, hospitals, and even a high-speed rail company in Italy. Last March, MSC also announced a $23 billion deal to buy 43 ports owned by billionaire Li Ka-shing's Hong Kong-based conglomerate, CK Hutchison, alongside asset manager BlackRock. But the deal ran into objections from Beijing, and it's been stalled since last July, when CK Hutchison announced that it was looking to invite a major strategic investor from China to join the consortium. Aponte isn't waiting around. The estimated $900 million to $1.7 billion that MSC has sunk into the tanker market in recent months is its first foray into this new market. So far, the rest of the industry seems happy that the two firms keep building up their fleets, as long as it means more money for everyone else too. They've been very effective at pushing up the market, said Okeanis Eco Tankers CEO Aristides Alafouzos, the son of Greek tanker billionaire Giannisio Alafouzos, on a February earnings call. They've done the heavy lifting, and the rest of the market will reap the rewards. In addition to the tanker business, who else wins? Here's an article from Forbes magazine dated the 10th of March, 2026, by Christopher Hellman. Title of the article is, "The American Liquid Natural Gas Billionaires Set to Cash In on War with Iran. Iranian drones damaged the world's biggest liquefied gas complex at Qatar's Ras Laffan last week. Attacks on oil tankers have closed the Straits of Hormuz, blocking the only path to market for Qatar Energy, which had to shut down its plants and declare force majeure on LNG shipments. It's unclear when it will restart. The most optimistic timeline to resume full production is 1 month, predicted TPH analyst Zach Von Everen last year. Two of the biggest likely beneficiaries of this development, Robert Pender and Mike Sable, the co-founders of America's soon-to-be biggest exporter of liquefied natural gas, Venture Global. Incredibly, from its first cargo just 4 years ago, Venture Global is on track to export about half of what pioneering LNG giant Qatar would have this year, a roughly 40 million tons of supercooled minus 260-degree liquid natural gas. It's an enormous amount, the energy equivalent of 16 billion gallons of gasoline, enough to fill 500 insulated tankers to be shipped around the world. We probably have the largest number of available cargoes in the market, CEO Sable, 59, said in an earnings call last week, which puts him and Pender, 72, based in Arlington, Virginia, in the best position of any global energy tycoons to profit enormously from the sudden need to plug the shortfall. Spot prices for LNG cargoes have more than doubled, and gas in Europe is now going for 5 times the price of pipeline gas in Louisiana, home to Venture Global's 2 megaprojects, Calcasieu Pass LNG and Plaquemines LNG. They're in a unique position, says Jason Fear, head of LNG intelligence for consultancy Potency and Partners. They have a lot of volume that they can sell into this spike. It's the latest gamble that's paid off for this duo, who have more personal skin in the global LNG game than anyone. Already, the two billionaires, who own 80% of Venture Global shares, have seen their fortunes jump nearly 29% to over $12 billion apiece since the U.S. attacked Iran. In comparison, shares of America's biggest LNG producer, Cheniere Energy, are up 9% in the same time. Pender and Sable spent the past decade scouting, engineering, financing, and erecting its 2 LNG mega projects, now operational on the Louisiana coast at Calcasieu Pass, on the Gulf Coast east of Beaumont, and in Plaquemines Parish near New Orleans, the latter built at a cost of $23 billion on the west bank of the Mississippi, 55 miles upriver from the Gulf of Mexico, shipped its first cargo in late 2024. Despite no LNG experience, Sable, an investment banker, and Pender, a D.C. attorney who represented India, China, and Guyana in financing energy megaprojects and is married to JFK's niece, saw vast future demand for U.S. LNG exports. So they hatched a plan in 2010 to build LNG liquefaction bigger and faster than competitors. Whereas many older LNG plants might produce 5 million tons a year from each single giant liquefaction train, VG instead decided to go with smaller trains built in a factory by Baker Hughes. These units would produce just 700,000 tons each year, but there would be many more of them. In Calcasieu Pass LNG project, the first to deploy these machines at large scale, has 18 modules, now producing 12 million tons per year. Its second project, Plaquemines LNG, which now has 36 trains, is expected to run at a rate of 28 million tons this year. Already VG, as it's often called, is off to a strong start. Even before the latest developments, 2025 revenues hit $13.6 billion, up from $7.9 billion in 2024. Net income hit $2.2 billion, up from $1.5 billion in 2024. VG's growth plans call for a doubling in size of each location. One other reason these founders will likely cash in is their apparent willingness to aggravate vital customers. Even before they could finance construction of these plants, VG needed to find long-term off-takers who agreed to buy set amounts of LNG for 20 years once the newfangled plants were fully operational. Among those who signed up were oil giants Shell, BP, and Chevron. But even after Calcasieu Pass was operational, Venture Global insisted on selling the product on the spot market for its own account. Blaming an extensive commissioning process, pre-commercial shipments of LNG are supposed to undergo final testing and safety inspections before full operation. Shell, BP, and others filed arbitration claims in early 2023, demanding to be paid $8 billion in profits on 350 commissioning cargoes shipped from Calcasieu during what happened to be record high prices. Shell, which sought $3.5 billion, lost in both arbitration and on its appeal. Meanwhile, BP won an arbitration last October, which means VG may be on the hook for damages as high as $3.7 billion. The BP news sent VG shares plummeting 50%, but they've since recovered more than half that sum thanks to the war. Undeterred, Pender and Sable have already been shipping hundreds of pre-commercial cargoes out of Plaquemines and expect hundreds more to go out before the big oil customers start getting their promised supplies. After all, the economics right now are stunningly good for American LNG exports, especially ones like VG that owns its own plants and tankers. It has nine. With an average profit of about $40 million per cargo, everyone's trying to wring more efficiency out of their equipment, says Fear. Venture Global will clearly be the biggest beneficiary of that. Analysts figure that for every extra dollar per MMBTU that VG can tack on in fees or price realizations this year, it'll generate $600 million in additional EBIT data, or up to $8 billion EBITDA, up from $6.3 billion last year. Compare that with Cheniere Energy, currently the U.S.'s biggest LNG exporter, which has far fewer uncontracted cargoes available this year and will likely only make another $50 million more per dollar. A spokeswoman for Venture Global points out that the company has contracted 70% of its 500 or so expected cargoes this year, and that, despite the uncertainties of war, they are not extending the commissioning period on Plaquemines and intend to declare commerciality well within its contractually obligated window period of the fourth quarter of 2026. That would make Plaquemines the fastest large-scale LNG facility to reach commerciality, she says. Venture Global was responsible for more than half of all the new LNG capacity added worldwide in the past year, and they know LNG buyers won't have a lot of other options until the Strait of Hormuz reopens. There was talk earlier this year that Europe might relax its sanctions on Russian gas, but then Russian LNG tanker Arctic Metagaz exploded and sank in the Mediterranean Tuesday night, the crew apparently escaping by life raft to Libya. Russia blamed Ukrainian sea drones, leading President Vladimir Putin to threaten that maybe it would make sense for us to stop the supply of gas to European markets right now. Who knows how much of that they'll keep in the long run, given their deals with the big oil giants. They'll make 15 or 20 billion. Maybe they have to pay back a few billion, says Fear. My guess is they'll feel okay with that. The bigger question is what Venture Global will do with all this cash. Pender and Sable, who each pocketed more than $50 million last year in salary bonuses and dividends, will likely enjoy a nice payout, some of which will likely go to support pro-LNG politicians like President Donald Trump, who reversed Joe Biden's presidential LNG permitting pause. Sable visited Mar-a-Lago in 2024 and gave $1 million to the Trump inaugural campaign. Otherwise, Sable says they'll keep reinvesting earnings into the next $20 billion of expansion projects. If they keep up the pace of construction, by the time all current projects are complete in a couple of years, Pender and Sable will preside over 81 million tons per year of LNG capacity, even more than Qatar on a good day. Here's an article from Fortune magazine dated March 16, 2022, by Anne D'Ossenzio. Title of the article is Air Travel is the Political Football. Airline CEOs pen a letter to Congress to fund aviation workers. Air travel is the political football. The CEOs of the nation's top airline companies, including American, Delta, Southwest, and JetBlue, are imploring Congress to restore funding to the Department of Homeland Security and embrace a bipartisan solution to pay federal aviation workers, including airport security officers, during the partial government shutdown. Once again, air travel is the political football amid another government shutdown. The executive wrote in an open letter to Congress that was published Sunday online and in the Washington Post. The letter, which was also signed by the CEOs of the cargo companies UPS, FedEx, and Atlas Air, said that Congress should pass the Aviation Funding Solvency Act and the Aviation Funding Stability Act, which would guarantee air traffic controllers are paid regardless of the government's funding status, as well as the Keep America Flying Act. That measure would offer the same protections to Transportation Security Administration officers tasked to provide security and to screen all travelers. It's difficult, if not impossible, to put food on the table, put gas in the car, and pay rent when you're not getting paid, the letter said. The current partial shutdown affects only the Department of Homeland Security, which includes TSA. Democrats in Congress refused to fund the department over objections to its immigration enforcement tactics. The lapse marks the third shutdown in less than a year to leave TSA workers temporarily without pay. Once the government reopens, to have to wait for back pay. Democratic lawmakers have said DHS won't get funded until new restrictions are in place on federal immigration operations following the fatal shootings of Alex Preddy and Renee Good in Minneapolis earlier this year. The CEOs noted that with spring break in full swing, FIFA's World Cup 2026 approaching, and celebrations for America's 250th birthday throughout the year, the stakes are high. The letter said that U.S. airlines expect 171 million passengers this spring season. As the latest partial shutdown drags on, there have been many security lines at a growing number of U.S. airports. The TSA and Homeland Security have consistently blamed Democrats for the long security lines. Homeland Security posted on its X account last week that more than 300 TSA agents have quit since the start of the shutdown. As many of you probably already know, we're on the verge of saying goodbye to Jerome Powell as chairman of the Fed. And here's an article dealing with just that from Fortune magazine by Eleanor Pringle, dated March 16th. The title of the article is, "This week is Jerome Powell's penultimate meeting as chairman of the Fed. Don't expect him to drop Wall Street many hints." In a matter of months, a new face will stand behind the lectern at the U.S. Federal Reserve following the meeting of its rate-setting committee. Jerome Powell has in all likelihood got only a few press conferences left before his term as central bank chairman ends, an event he may increasingly be looking forward to. With Powell's term due to end in May, unless delayed by a legal back and forth arising out of a Department of Justice investigation, the chairman will lead the Federal Open Market Committee, the FOMC, meetings this week and in April before stepping aside, likely for Trump nominee Kevin Warsh to take his place. Despite the drama surrounding Powell's final year leading the Fed, Wall Street isn't expecting anything particularly surprising from the Powell-led meetings. In the past few months, the FOMC has been split over how quickly and deeply rates should be cut, if at all, and recent military action in Iran will do little to firm up the economic outlook. Geopolitical tensions have bubbled over since the U.S. and Israel launched strikes in Iran 17 days ago. Since then, oil prices have been increased as traders assess how severe supply from the region will be disrupted. Rising oil prices have a direct knock-on impact for households, with their inflation expectations soaring as they scour headlines for a de-escalation in tensions, which is yet to appear. With price expectations rising and with limited contemporary data to inform the Fed about the real economy now, analysts are largely expecting Jerome Powell to announce no cut this week. At the time of writing, CME's FedWatch places more than a 99% chance of a hold at the meeting this week. Despite the fact that this week is something of a central bank bonanza, the Fed, the European Central Bank, the Bank of Japan, and the Bank of England all meet this week, there's a general perception that wait and see will once again prevail. Economists also aren't expecting anything major from Powell's presser, as Deutsche Bank's Jim Reid noted to clients this morning, saying his team only expects minor statement tweaks, including smooth language on recent labor data, especially given January and February's conflicting payrolls, and a nod to geopolitical risks, highlighting uncertainty and near-term upside pressure on inflation. He continued, Powell's press conference is likely to stress that recent events mainly transmit through financial conditions, particularly oil prices. For now, however, our economists think that he'll avoid signaling any meaningful shift in the near-term policy outlook. Indeed, some analysts have even suggested that it's entirely plausible that there will be no cuts at all in 2026. After all, a dovish new chairman is only one vote on the FOMC. But Bank of America Global Research's Antonio Gabriel wrote this morning that perhaps hawkish inflation calls are overcrowding the picture when it comes to the Fed's path forward. Gabriel wrote that to assume the Fed won't cut is based on the assumption that geopolitical tensions are transitory, that inflation may be a relatively short to medium-term hiccup, which will not impact the wider global economy. The B of A economist isn't so sure, writing this morning that markets could be underpricing a more protracted war. While a quick resolution to the conflict is certainly a possibility, we view the conflict extending into second quarter as an equally likely outcome, and a more protracted war cannot be ruled out. However, markets seem to be pricing a largely transitory shock, Gabriel observed. The U.S. dollar is stronger, but the S&P 500 is just 4% below its peak, and rates markets have priced out about 35 basis points of Fed's cuts by year-end due to inflation concerns. In our view, the more disruptive scenarios for global growth are underpriced. It's very difficult to ignore Elon Musk for any length of time, and this next article is this week's offering on what's going on inside XAI and SpaceX. It's from Fortune magazine, written by Marco Quiroz Gutierrez. The title of the article is, Elon Musk admits XAI wasn't built right, as only two co-founders remain and its biggest AI bet stalls out. Elon Musk said he's rebuilding XAI up from the ground, just a month after SpaceX acquired his AI startup in one of the biggest mergers of all time. Following a gradual exodus from XAI, the world's richest man is trying to reimagine the company with heightened ambitions. The Tesla and SpaceX CEO added in a post on X last week that XAI was undergoing a process similar to an earlier one at Tesla, which Musk has been CEO of since 2008. XAI was not built right the first time around, so is being rebuilt from the foundations up, he wrote in the post. Musk said the purpose of the SpaceX acquisition is building orbital data centers, which he said are the most cost-effective ways of producing AI computing power. Yet here on Earth, Musk is dealing with a seemingly less lofty, but all too important staffing issue. A pair of XAI co-founders left the company last week, and two others bailed last month, Business Insider reported, meaning nine of the original 11 co-founders, not named after Musk, have left the company since 2024. These most recent departures come after an exodus of about a dozen senior engineers. The precipitous loss of talent has stalled the company's biggest AI bet, MicroHard, its effort to build an AI agent capable of doing anything a white-collar worker can do, has reportedly been put on pause in the past days, as its leader, Toby Polan, left the company just weeks after being appointed to head the project. While all the exits raise question about the company's future, Musk has downplayed the brain drain as part of a planned reorganization. Some employees are better suited for the early stage of a venture rather than later stages, he said at an all-hands meeting last month, according to the New York Times. Representatives for XAI did not immediately respond to a request for comment. The XAI CEO is now looking to aggressively hire, albeit from an extremely limited pool of AI-focused workers. Already, the AI company has been able to poach two employees, Andrew Milich and Jason Ginsberg, from AI coding company Cursor, the information reported. These hires are key because of the potential growth in the coding tools market, which stood at $7.65 billion as of 2025 and is projected to grow to $22.2 billion by 2030. Cursor itself was valued at $29.3 billion after raising $2.3 billion in a funding round in November. Despite these successful recruitments, Musk has said he and a colleague are looking over rejected XAI applications to look for promising candidates. Many talented people over the past few years were declined an offer or even an interview at XAI. My apologies, he wrote. We've already talked about rising fuel costs in the United States. But what about Asia? Here's an article from Fortune that deals with that. The article is by Barrett Bingley. It's dated March 16th, 2026. The closed Strait of Hormuz is testing Asia's energy security. The answer lies across the Pacific, in Canada. When IRGC Brigadier General Ebrahim Jabari declared the Strait of Hormuz to be closed, 150 oil and LNG tankers decided to stay put rather than risk getting fired on. Qatar Energy and other oil and gas producers soon halted production, declaring force majeure. The effect on Asia was immediate, with LNG benchmarks jumping 39% in just one session, and governments now frantically ordering staff to work from home to save energy. The threat to Asia has been obvious for years. The U.S. Energy Information Administration estimated that in 2024, over 80% of the crude and LNG that transited Hormuz went to Asian markets. China, India, Japan, and South Korea accounted for nearly 70% of all Hormuz crude flows. Saudi Arabia and the UAE can only send about 2.6 million barrels of crude a day through bypass pipelines, and not enough to offset the 20 million barrels per day that's now stuck. It's even worse for LNG. There's no way to get it out if Hormuz is closed. If Asian countries want a solution to their energy woes in the Middle East, perhaps they should look, well, to the east, across the Pacific, to energy sources in North America and Canada in particular. Canada's new Pacific energy infrastructure, from the Shell-led LNG Canada project in Kitimat to the expanded Transit Mountain pipeline feeding crude to tankers near Vancouver, offers Asian buyers a faster, cheaper, and politically safer route that can skip Hormuz and other choke points like Malacca and the South China Sea altogether. There's no technological fix for geography, as author Robert D. Kaplan argued in his 2012 book, The Revenge of Geography. The only solution is a different map, and for Asia's energy buyers, the different map is on Canada's Pacific coast. LNG Canada in Kitimat, British Columbia, shipped its first cargo in June 2025, making Canada an LNG exporting nation for the first time. Cargoes load directly into the North Pacific and reach Northeast Asian terminals without passing through the Strait of Hormuz, the Strait of Malacca, or the South China Sea, all potential choke points for energy trade. Canadian crude from Alberta now moves through the Trans Mountain Expansion Pipeline, the TMX pipeline, which came online in May 2024 and has now nearly tripled maximum capacity to 890,000 barrels per day. Since startup, shipments from the Westridge Marine Terminal near Vancouver have helped triple Canadian crude exports to non-U.S. destinations, with Asia, particularly China, emerging as a key buyer. The Alberta to Asia route does not rely on Hormuz or Malacca, and it originates in a jurisdiction perceived as politically stable. Importantly, Canada is low risk, and one hopes unlikely to be beset by conflict anytime soon. The U.S., the world's largest LNG exporter, can't help gas-hungry Asian buyers. The reason, again, is geography. The U.S.'s LNG export terminals are on the Gulf Coast or the East Coast. None are on the Pacific Coast. It can take up to 24 days to get an LNG tanker from the Gulf Coast through the Panama Canal and to Japan. Shipping from Kitimat in Canada takes just 11 days. Canadian LNG from Kitimat takes roughly 10 to 11 days at a delivered cost of under $1 per MMBTU versus $2 MMBTU or more via Panama, according to energy research firm RBN Energy. Canada's route is shorter, cheaper, and avoids congestion in the canal. Washington is building the Alaska LNG project, an 800-mile pipeline from North Slope gas fields to a liquefaction terminal at Nikiski on Cook Inlet. It's got support from the Trump administration, federal permits, and letters of intent from JERA and POSCO. But Alaska LNG still lacks binding long-term contracts, and some estimates put the cost at more than $70 billion. Even if construction begins as planned in late 2026, the first LNG exports won't be ready until 2031 at the earliest, and that assumes everything goes right. In contrast, LNG Canada Phase 1 is operational and ready to serve Asian buyers today. The next tranche of Canadian LNG is about to come online. LNG Canada Phase 12 will provide a further 14 million tons per annum through a JV that includes Shell, Mitsubishi, Korean Gas Corporation, Petronas, and PetroChina. A final investment decision is expected by late 2026 or early 2027. Ksi Lisims LNG near Port Rupert has cleared all regulatory approvals. If both proceed, Canada's total Pacific LNG export capacity will exceed 40 million tons per annum by the early 2030s. Asian utilities and importers, from JERA and INPEX to CNOOC, GAIL, CPC Taiwan, and Singapore's EMA, that lock in 20 to 40 year contracts, will have structural insurance against the next Hormuz-related supply shock that will look extraordinarily cheap in hindsight. And they'd find a willing partner in Ottawa, which is actively encouraging Asian participation as part of a broader effort to diversify energy exports away from an over-reliance on the U.S. market. Tankers anchored outside Hormuz and the burning facilities at Ras Laffan are a live demonstration of what happens when energy security relies on a 33-kilometer-wide passage flanked by a hostile power. Asia's energy buyers need to find an alternative, and fortunately, they have one in Canada. For those of you who are Disney fans or investors, today, March 18th, is Bob Iger's last day leading Disney. Here's an article from Jacqueline Muniz from Fortune magazine, dated March 18th. Today's Bob Iger's last day leading Disney. Here's what comes next at the company worth $176 billion. Today marks the start of a new era for Disney as longtime CEO Bob Iger officially passes the baton to his successor, Josh D'Amaro, at the company's annual shareholders meeting. D'Amaro, a 28-year veteran of the company, was named Iger's replacement on February 3rd. He most recently served as head of Disney Experiences, which include the company's theme parks, cruise line, resorts, and consumer products. Disney and D'Amaro have said very little about how he plans to lead the company, and today's shareholder meeting could offer a first glimpse into the company's direction at a pivotal moment for the media industry. The company, with a market cap of $175.98 billion, will have to contend with a shifting landscape as competitor Paramount Skydance prepares to acquire Warner Brothers, potentially cutting into the company's market share. Since Iger returned as CEO in 2022, the company's shares have underperformed compared to the wider market. The company's message around D'Amaro's ascension has focused on ensuring a smooth transition following the short, controversy-filled tenure of Iger's first replacement, Bob Chapek. A key difference this time is that Iger will temporarily stay on as a senior advisor and board member, even though he's stepping down as CEO 8 months ahead of schedule. After appointing Chapek in 2020, Iger remained full-time as executive chairman and directed Disney's creative projects. Former Morgan Stanley CEO James Gorman, who's been Disney's board chairman since 2025, led the succession planning committee to replace Iger. Bob came to the point where he had developed the talent, and he said, "This is for me to step aside now," Gorman said in an interview with CNBC last month. Yes, he could technically be CEO through the end of his contract. That wasn't the aspiration. The aspiration was to get the company ready and to get the talent ready, not worrying about what the contract says. He later added that this time there would be no drama. This new structure will allow for a clean break and orderly succession, board advisor and lawyer Richard LeBlanc previously told Fortune. There is always pressure on the new CEO when the old CEO is there to not make any sudden moves and to carry on the CEO's legacy, said LeBlanc. In contrast, when the old CEO moves on, they exit the company so that the new CEO can find their way and implement change without feeling as though someone is looking over their shoulder. Disney also announced Dana Walden, who was widely reported to be a CEO contender, will become the company's president and chief creative officer, a new role. Walden previously served as the co-chairman of Disney Entertainment, where she oversaw Disney's movies, television, news, and content business. Even though D'Amaro will be her boss, Walden's base salary of $3.75 million is roughly 50% higher than D'Amaro's starting base salary of $2.5 million, a strategic incentive for an executive who could have left the company after losing the top job. D'Amaro will have to fill Iger's legendary shoes after a nearly two-decade tenure that included the acquisition of the company's most iconic brands, including Pixar in 2006, Marvel Entertainment in 2009, and Lucasfilm in 2012. Disney's also made major investments in its theme parks and plans to open a new theme park and resort in Abu Dhabi. The incoming CEO is well positioned to lead the company's growth. Under D'Amaro, Disney's parks and experiences have become the company's primary profit engine, accounting for more than 70% of operating income despite representing under 40% of total revenue. Streaming is the other major growth driver for the company, following consecutive quarters of profitability. The slow transition aligns with D'Amaro's leadership style, as he told students at his alma mater, Georgetown University, last year. He prefers to approach new roles by listening. There's gravity to a business card with your title on it. You start to take on that identity, but that is not who you are, DeMauro told the students. Now, every time I walk into a new job, I say, I don't know, but I know you do, and I know I can help. We've done a number of articles on the acquisition of Warner Brothers by Paramount. So, if the acquisition closes, what does David Zaslav, the president of Warner Brothers, make? Here's an article from Forbes magazine, dated March 18th. Zaslav will earn more than $667 million after Warner Brothers Discovery sale to Paramount is closed, Warner Brothers Discovery disclosed late Monday. That includes $34.2 million in severance, $517.2 million in equity, and vested stock awards estimated to be worth $115.8 million, Warner Brothers Discovery said. Though Zaslav could earn an additional $335.4 million tax reimbursement, potentially bringing his total payout to just over $1 billion. It's unlikely the tax reimbursement will be that large by the time the sale closes. The company calculated the reimbursement on March 11th, and the later Paramount's deal for Warner Brothers Discovery closes, the smaller Zaslav's payment becomes. The tax reimbursement could be reduced to zero should the deal be completed in 2027, Warner Brothers Discovery said. Zaslav has earned hundreds of millions of dollars over the decades as a media executive, including more than $246 million as Discovery Communications CEO in 2021 and roughly $152 million in 2014, with his $3 million salary boosted by stock awards and bonuses in recent years. So if you ever wonder why so many men strive for the top job in a company, to be chief executive officer of a company, now you know the rewards can be quite remarkable. And folks, that's all we have time for today. This is Sun Sounds of Arizona. The program is Business World. I'm Steve Klein. See you next Monday at 11 a.m. As always, thanks for listening.